We firmly thought that we had given them everything they asked for and done everything they wanted us, and that we had shown them the records from which they could have gotten the answers.
Senator Ted Stevens begins a tough month of campaigning in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 4th of August. Good evening, I'm Duncan Moon. Also tonight, another bear attack near Anchorage.
Mr. Reese had sustained several animal bites from the bear to both legs and one of his arms.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Harvesting wild game is extremely important to many Alaskans, not only as a food source, but as a long-standing traditional practice. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is committed to maintaining healthy caribou and moose populations. To learn more about the principles and guidelines behind predator management, visit wildlife.alaska.gov or contact your local fish and game office. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska, Department of Fish and Game.
Senator Ted Stevens is back in the state after last week's indictment on seven felony charges. Senator Stevens discussed the charges and his re-election bid during a visit to Ketchikan over the weekend. KRBD's Deanna Garrison has the story.
Despite a number of polls showing him trailing presumptive Democratic nominee Mark Begich, Stevens says it is the verdict of his upcoming trial that will determine whether he'll continue his reign as the U.S. Senate's longest-serving Republican.
The verdict is the general election. But let's face it.
Stevens says he is innocent. He says he was surprised when a Washington, D.C. grand jury handed down the indictment last week.
We firmly thought that we had given them everything they asked for and done everything they wanted us, and that we had shown them the records from which they could have gotten the answers that we will not deliver in trial. I did not expect this indictment. The way it was presented, the fact that it just came out of the blue, we did not expect it. Normally, a case would not be brought against a candidate so close to an election.
Stevens pled not guilty in federal district court Thursday on charges that he failed to disclose upwards of $250,000 worth of gifts and services from Vico and former Vico CEO Bill Allen. Allen and Vico Vice President Rick Smith have pled guilty to charges that they bribed state politicians. Stevens reminded voters Saturday that he is not accused of taking bribes.
This investigation is on a charge, a case brought against me for failure to disclose gifts. It's not some multi-million dollar scandal or bribery charge or anything else. It is a failure to disclose gifts.
Stevens says he is grateful that he was granted a speedy trial, which he expects to be completed before the November general election. Jury selection in that trial is tentatively scheduled to begin on September 24th.
I'm coming home very much really reassured at the soundness of our whole constitutional system.
Stevens' legal team is asking to move the trial from Washington, D.C. to Alaska. He says the primary reason for that request is for the convenience of some 40 to 60 witnesses expected to be called at trial, most of whom live in Alaska. Stevens' indictment became front-page national news last week. A number of his Senate colleagues facing re-election have since made efforts to distance themselves from Stevens, returning money from his political action committee. A senior advisor for Senator John McCain's presidential campaign said the charges are a sad reminder of the work the next president will have to do to rebuild the public's trust. Stevens downplayed those statements Saturday and said his only problem is with McCain's staff, not with McCain himself.
That staff has hated me since the time they were on the Commerce Committee with him. They don't like Alaskans or Alaska. They don't like me. They don't like Anwar. They don't like anything about us. So just forget about him. I can get along with John, all right? He did vote for Anwar once. They forget that.
Overall, Stevens says his Senate colleagues have remained supportive.
None of them, to my face, have been critical. Let's put it that way, all right?
Alaska Congressman Don Young was also in Ketchikan Saturday and was asked to comment on the indictment.
Ted's my friend. That's all I'm going to say.
Both Young and Stevens are traveling the state this month. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Congressman Don Young has raised about $54,000 for his legal expense fund. Young is the subject of a federal investigation and started the fund in January in order to raise money for his legal costs. In the first few months, the fund didn't raise any money, but the financial disclosure filings turned into the House Legislative Council last week show that during the year's second quarter, the fund picked up steam and received the $54,000 from donors. During the same quarter, Young spent nearly $50,000 on his personal legal fees and an additional $80,000 on legal fees for his campaign and his campaign manager, Steve Doherty. The money raised in Young's legal defense fund cannot pay for anything other than his personal legal fees, so money spent on the other legal matters must come from somewhere else. He can use his campaign fund to pay legal expenses for himself and his campaign, and he has, as his legal bills have totaled more than $1 million. The special session of the State House and Senate is still going on at the Capitol in Juneau, with members trying to come up with measures that would help people pay their energy bills this year, while also taking steps that would lead to a future reduction in the amount of energy people use. APRN's Dave Donaldson joins us from Juneau. Hi, Dave.
Hi there.
Give us a snapshot of where this is. What's on the table?
Well, you know, it started out very simple. Governor Palin wanted a one-time payment of $1,200 to everybody in Alaska. It would have cost the state about $800 million overall. Since then, the question of equity came up. The lawmakers, you know, people who need it, people what they need, and lawmakers just now want a little bit more. The Senate began by adding a program that was going to set a ceiling on the price of home heating oil, $3 a gallon for, you wouldn't have to pay more than $300 or $3 a gallon. The state would cover the difference. Then there was a separate bill introduced to increase the support for power cost equalization program that helps rural residents pay their electric bills. Another plan came along then that would extend the power cost equalization to urban residents. Then an idea that the state could help pay for wood-burning heaters and pellet stoves and then increases to the Renewable Energy Fund. And finally, the Senate's hung up right now over whether to reduce the cost of natural gas to South Central customers. It's all vague right now. Senators have basically spent the last 2 days arguing among themselves over whether that is really justifiable or not. It's also somewhere in the neighborhood of more than $1 billion that they want to spend on this one-time fix.
Well, it sounds like there's an awful lot still on the table, and it's not simple stuff. It's pretty complex. How are they going to get this done in the next couple of days? Will they get it done in the next couple of days?
There is seriously has been some talk now about saying, well, maybe we should just go do the real basics. I mean, this is the sort of thing that would have trouble getting worked out in a regular session, 90 days. And it's questionable right now whether any of it could pass, as convoluted as it is. So I think that, you know, they're either going to work some miracles, I wouldn't put it past them, or else they're going to have to just back off.
Well, what are the politics that are coming to play here?
The politics are all over the spectrum, except it's not partisan. It's more geographic. And it's reminding me of the arguments over education funding that was not settled until this year. And that took, you know, the better part of a decade to untie all the mess about area cost differentials and various different parts and ways of funding different things. And once they get that worked out, there's also the Senate versus the House. Each one has its own controversial elements within this package. Those ideas there come from both different places. And once they resolve things on their own side, someone's got to put these two versions together. And they only have until Thursday night before the session ends, and I don't think anybody wants to come back again. So it's all up in the air right now.
Well, it seems like it'll be an interesting 2 days ahead. Dave, thanks for bringing us up to date.
My pleasure.
APRN's Dave Donaldson reporting from Juneau. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, BP experiments with recovering an untapped source on the North Slope.
The heavy oil is as thick as molasses. It doesn't flow easily.
That's just ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by The Rasmussen Foundation, accepting applications from Alaska artists for project awards. The deadline is September 1st.
An Eagle River man fended off a bear attack early this morning. It's the fourth attack or near miss with bears in the Anchorage area this summer. APRN's Eli Menica reports.
18-year-old Devin Reese was walking home around 2 a.m. along VFW Road in Eagle River when he was suddenly attacked by a large bear. Reese fought back, punching, kicking, yelling, and screaming during the attack in order to scare the bear away. He later walked to safety and called for help. Lieutenant Paul Honeman, the Director of Public Affairs for the Anchorage Police Department, says police responded to the scene and called paramedics to attend to Reese's injuries.
Mr. Reese had sustained several animal bites from the bear to both legs and one of his arms. Mr. Reese also complained of a head injury, stating that when he fell to the ground during the attack, it struck his head on an unknown object.
Reese was released from the hospital after being treated for his wounds. Wildlife biologist Rick Sinnott with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game says that although the number of attacks in Anchorage this summer has been high, bears are not attacking due to hunger. Sinnott says a stream near the area of the encounter is full of spawning king salmon, and Reese likely surprised the bear.
You can expect that there will be brown bears on salmon spawning areas, especially out in the woods, and this was kind of on the edge of town, but it was certainly right adjacent to Jugash State Park. And you can expect there'll be brown bears there, so you just have to, exercise caution, avoid them if possible, but at least make noise and carry pepper spray or a light or something to kind of warn the bear you're coming.
Although Reese could not definitively identify the type of bear that attacked him, Sinnott says evidence points to a brown bear.
We found wet, footprints basically coming up out of the creek within a few yards of where he crossed the creek on the driveway, and brown bear hairs on some of the limbs right in that track where the bear had come up, and the bear hairs were fresh enough that they were basically stuck to leaves with water, so it made sense. And a police officer who lives in the neighborhood down there near the creek said that he saw a brown bear with a cub walk through their condo area towards the Meadow Creek at 11:30 that night. So that would have been just an hour or two before the attack occurred.
Both Sinnott and Lieutenant Honeman advise people in possible bear-populated areas to travel in groups and make plenty of noise to alert the bears to your presence. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Eli Miniker.
Governor Sarah Palin was in Fairbanks today to sign a disaster declaration for flooded areas of the borough. State officials toured the flooded area from a helicopter on Saturday. Borough Emergency Services spokeswoman Sally Stuvek says water levels on the Tanana have stabilized at Nanana.
The waters aren't rising anymore, but they're, still having significant flooding issues.
Stuvek says to the north and east, waters of the Tanana, Salcha, and Chena rivers are dropping, and that's improved conditions in areas of Salcha and Fairbanks that flooded last week.
All of the roads that had been closed are all now passable except for Chief John, which is in the Rosie Creek area. So we have seen quite a gradual decrease in the affected flooded areas. What's occurring now, however, is groundwater that's being reported. The ground is so saturated that as additional rainfall comes or the water comes from upstream, there's just really nowhere for it to go.
Stuvek says rising groundwater has been a problem in the Moose Creek area, where about 15 to 20 homes have been affected. The borough estimates that between 300 and 500 structures borough-wide have had water damage. Stuvek says a few people were still staying at a Red Cross emergency shelter in Fairbanks yesterday, but that most people have returned to their houses.
We are asking, as residents are able to get back into their homes, that they keep appropriate documentation to the damage that they've had. And so that can be by photographs, by video camera. We also, as they go and purchase supplies to do repairs, have asked that they keep all of those receipts for invoices in case there's a possibility at some point of reimbursement of some of these costs.
Falling water levels at Nanana are allowing the Alaska Railroad to repair a 25-foot section of washed-out rail bed. The railroad also reported some track was still submerged yesterday. Freight and passenger service are expected to resume by late tomorrow. Lowering the gates at the Chena Flood Control Dam last week has left behind a massive pile of wood. Project manager John Schoch says the dam strains out trees floated by high water.
Every time, we start building water up on the bank, upstream of the dam, you know, that cleans all the debris that's been laying on the bank off into the river, and it comes down and intercepts the dam.
Shroke says the trees are being picked up with a crane and carried away in dump trucks. He says the logs will be piled up on the north side of the Chena River for later access by the public.
Excellent firewood that hasn't been sitting around in the water, and there'll be enough for some people to come in and cut and maybe get a load or two of firewood.
Shroke says the trees will be available for cutting after the wood dries out. He expects the logs to go fast due to increased interest in wood burning, spurred by high oil prices. UAA's Institute of Social and Economic Research, ICER, has a new study out regarding the turnover of teachers in Alaska. KBBI's Mike Mason has the story.
The Institute has been tracking teacher turnover in Alaska in partnership with the Alaska Teacher Placement Program and the Department of Education and Early Development. According to the research summary that was released last week, turnover among Alaska's teachers was roughly the same in 2007 as it was in 1999, with about 14% of teachers leaving their school district. Teacher turnover is especially pronounced in rural Alaska, with about 22% of teachers leaving their jobs compared to 10% in urban school districts in the state. The research summary was co-authored by Diane Hirschberg, who's an associate professor for education policy. She says there are a number of factors that are apparently influencing the decision by teachers to leave their jobs.
Several which we don't yet have a handle on include the fact that wages are not as high in the state relative to other states as they used to be. You know, there used to be a premium. If you were an educator and you came to work in Alaska, your salary was much, much higher than it would be if you were in other states. And now it's higher, but not necessarily enough to make up for the distance from your families if you're coming from out of state or the expenses, particularly in rural Alaska. Then we have some changes more recently, such as the retirement system. We no longer have one of the better retirement systems in the country.
Hirschberg says another factor that may be impacting teachers in their decision to leave a teaching job is the new teaching licensing system that was put in place in 2005.
One of the requirements is by the end of your second year as a new teacher in the state, you have to produce two 45-minute videotapes of your teaching, and those are assessed by a group of educators who've been trained together, and they determine whether you're going to move to the next stage from being a provisionally licensed teacher to being a fully licensed teacher in the state. And there are people for whom that's just more work than they want to do.
The research summary found that keeping special education teachers in Alaska schools is especially difficult, with about half of the new special education teachers leaving their job within 4 years. Of those teachers, 41% left teaching in Alaska schools entirely, and 8% were still teaching, but had switched to something other than special education. One of the encouraging findings included in the summary is that teachers and principals who graduated from programs based in Alaska are more likely to stay than teachers who graduated from programs based outside of the state. In Homer, I'm Mike Mason.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by STEMS, where thoughts are sent with flowers and gifts can be blooming with color and aroma. STEMS in Anchorage at 907-563-3366.
BP is beginning a $100 million experiment to test drilling techniques for raising heavy oil on the North Slope. BP spokesman Steve Reinert says the ultra-thick crude cannot be freed with traditional drilling techniques.
The heavy oil that is the focus of this research project is as thick as molasses. It doesn't flow easily. And this research project is testing out one of the potential technologies that could work in recovering this resource.
The research is aimed at the Ungu Formation, an area of heavy oil that the company has already drilled through to tap lighter underlying crude deposits. Reinhardt says the first of several technologies that will be tested is a technique that goes by the acronym CHOPS for cold, heavy oil production with sand.
This is a way of bringing oil and the sand from the formation into the well and bringing it all up together. That creates side channels that reach out. The idea is that creation of those channels will help this heavy oil flow out of the formation and into the well.
Similar technology has been used in other parts of the world, but Reinhardt says it's new to the extreme conditions on the North Slope. He says its potential here is vast, with an estimated 20 billion barrels of heavy oil in the region. He says even if 10% of that can be recovered, it would be a significant production. Last week, Wrangell Seafoods Incorporated received a foreclosure notice from its biggest creditor, Alaska Growth Capital. But the company's chairman, Doug Roberts, says they have found a way to pay that debt off and keep the plant operating. Lisa Fu of member station KSTK reports.
In 2007, Alaska Growth Capital loaned Wrangell Seafoods Incorporated $5.6 million for renovation upgrades to their seafood processing plant. According to Roberts, the renovations still aren't complete, and Wrangell Seafoods has been in default with AGC for several months, if not a year. But, he says, Wrangell Seafoods has a plan. The company has submitted a financing proposal to the creditor and is just waiting to hear back from AGC to accept the proposal and hopefully stop the foreclosure process. Roberts explains that the new plan would refinance Wrangell Seafoods as well as complete the construction project.
It'll just realign all of our debt, all of our credit issues into one loan, and it will remove Alaska Growth from that, and they'll be paid off in a roundabout way, according to the terms of the arrangement, with a new bank that has basically said, we will finance your company.
Robert says he cannot identify what bank he's referring to at this stage in the negotiations. Despite the notice of default and foreclosure, Robert says Wrangell Seafoods continues to have a good relationship with AGC and is in daily communication with the creditor. In fact, Robert says Wrangell Seafoods was well forewarned about the notice.
It was very important that they made clear that they would eventually have to move to foreclose because the fact that, you know, they have to collect money. They have to follow the rules that they have as a bank.
Robert says Wrangell Seafoods has been in negotiations with AGC for a few months and at one point had even tried to settle the $5.6 million balance with cash.
When I met with Alaska Growth, I said, worst case scenario, we can negotiate a payment. And he said, yeah, that's fine. But we weren't there to negotiate a payment. We were there with $3 million in cash to pay them off. So they didn't take my offer, obviously. But what, you know, and I respect that. So it's ongoing.
Roberts wants to assure the public that the notice of default and foreclosure will not affect Wrangell Seafood's current operation. Wrangell Seafoods will continue to buy salmon and crab throughout the summer, as well as cucumbers and prawns in the fall. He doesn't plan on the season being done until the end of November.
Wrangell Seafoods is continuing to grow, and along the way we have some growing pains, you know, and challenges, but we'll meet them.
This is Lisa Fu, reporting in Wrangell.
Anchorage's Tamodachi Daiko Taiko Drum Ensemble rocked the house at Lusac Library last week. The percussion group has about 90 members, ranging in age from third graders to adults. APRN's Ellen Lockyer has the story.
You don't have to be Japanese to love taiko drumming. Marianne Kerr is living proof of that.
You can't beat it for exercise and stress relief and just good fun.
The drum performance is a combination of choreography, calisthenics, and frenzied percussion. Kerr just finished performing with a few dozen other drummers on the sun-drenched library patio. Like the others, she's dressed all in black except for her soft white shoes.
These shoes are called tabi, and they are the performance shoes that we wear. Our sticks are called bachi. Our drumsticks are bachi. And today today, thank goodness, because it's so hot, we didn't wear the coats we usually wear, and they're called hoppy. The drumsticks, the drums, and the hoppy coats were all made by the volunteers.
She's clutching the bocce, used to play the larger drums called Nagato Daiko. They are drums made from a single piece of wood with heads on both ends.
Taiko means Japanese traditional drum, and originally made of a big tree trunk, and you hollow it. These days, we have high-tech taiko, which means kind of pieces that we put together like a wine barrel.
Sachiko Kono is a diminutive woman with enough energy for several people. She's a co-director of the group, and she keeps insistent rhythm on a set of small drums called Shimei Daiko. Tomodachi Daiko members and volunteers make all the drums except for the drum heads.
That's made of cow hide, and we have to order from certain places in California, different places, because we cannot use just any kind of hide. Any kind of cow we have has to have a certain very good high quality of hide to make a drum head.
During a performance, a couple of dozen drummers play multiple drums at one time, and they dance around the drums using elaborate gestures, waving their bocce overhead before pounding out the rhythm. Then they switch from one drum to another in perfectly choreographed moves.
We all take turns. All the drums are for all of us.
Taiko drums have roots in ancient Japan, although ensemble drumming like the taiko drumming of today got started in the 1950s by Japan's top jazz percussionists. Whatever its start, the art of taiko drumming has taken hold in North America, and there are groups throughout the United States and Canada. Tomodachi Daiko got its start in Anchorage's Sand Lake School Japanese Immersion Program. Now Anchorage area adults can join the drumming through a City Parks and Recreation Program.
This will really convince you taiko is for everyone. And the most important purpose of this taiko is have fun.
For those who can't get enough of taiko drumming, Tomodachi Daiko hosts drum groups Chakoma from Japan and Takahashi from Portland next week for an international taiko fest. The concert plays at West High School on August 11th. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Mike Mason in Homer, and Lisa Fu in Wrangell. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Eli Meniker and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer tonight is Dave Waldron. John Proffitt is our webmaster. And I'm Duncan Moon. From all of us here at APRN, good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the State of Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Information about the state's predator management program is available on the web at wildlife.alaska.gov.
The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Alaska has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has been sexually abused or injured by priests or anyone working for the Fairbanks Diocese. The deadline is December 2, 2008. Claim forms are available online at dioceseoffairbanks.org or by calling 1-888-570-6269. This message is sponsored by the Catholic Bishop of Northern Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.